Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The death of a child is the worst the world can offer any parent. For writer, comedian, and Studio Tulsa commentator Barry Friedman, it was understandably devastating. But his son's ongoing addiction issues made his death from a drug overdose not completely unexpected, but overwhelming nonetheless. Paul Friedman died nearly 12 years ago, but the grief remains even still today. In his book, 4 Days and a Year Later, An Elegy, Barry Friedman pays tribute and expresses his love and loss for a son who left this world far too soon. It offers little cautionary advice or steps to heal. It's simply a story of a parent's grief, the numbness, anger, second-guessing, and absolution that any parent experiences in the immediate aftermath of a tragic event like this. Assembled from his journal written in the days following Paul's death, the book follows the 4 days in the immediate aftermath of his son's death, plus a day year later, when closure begins to take place. Barry will be signing his book a week from today, Wednesday, January 15th at 5:30 at the Tulsa Press Club, and he's my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Barry Friedman, thank you very much for joining us today on Studio Tulsa.
My pleasure. Good to see you again.
Yeah. This book, 4 days and a year later, is an elegy for your son, Paul Friedman. It also reminds us, though, of all the numbness, the anger, sadness, and helplessness that comes with losing a loved one, especially in those first few days. Tell us about the decision to share this with others.
Well, let me just say the description you mentioned is also about parenting, the numbness and anger and everything else. Very simply, I decided I wanted to keep Paul alive. And since I'm a writer, I figured that would be the best way to do it, to write this. Had no idea what I was doing with it when I wrote it. At first, I actually thought of it as an apology for all the bad parenting decisions I made. But the more I wrote it, I thought, no, this is, and I hate the word celebration, and it wasn't a celebration. That's how I got to elegy. There was something about the last 4 days of his, not of his life, he had died, the 4 days after he died, and the memories of a year later, which said to me, he needs to be out there in the universe. I need to put him out in the universe. And so I wrote the book, again, just to put him out there so he wouldn't be forgotten.
For much of it, though, it is your relationship with him, and it is thoughts of second-guessing your parenting decisions. It's the thought of a relationship that ruptured at some point over drugs that was in his life. There was a lot of that.
Yeah. One of the problems with making a decision, for me, making a decision with how to parent even today, is there are a million decisions out there you could make, and you pick one. And when it doesn't go well, you think, well, maybe if I picked another one, it would have gone better, or it would have just been different. So your son does drugs, as I say in the book, and you find out he's doing drugs, and he's 14 when you find out he's doing drugs. What do you do as a parent? Well, you try to get between him and the drugs. You try to convince him there are more important things in life, people who love him. This will lead to no good. And all these ways to approach him doing drugs didn't work for me. I mean, all the cliches make sense, but none of them work. Tough love doesn't work. Unconditional love doesn't work. Carrot and stick doesn't work. None of it works. So you pick one. And at some point, I decided the only way I could show him that I was the parent and he was the child, and I was the one who loved him and needed to look after him, was to not be his friend. And that rupture you talk about, that's when I decided to end the relationship when he was 14. I couldn't pretend that he wasn't doing drugs when he was. So I stopped talking to him for a year and a half, thinking I was important to his life. If he had to make the decision between drugs and the love of his father, of course he would pick his father. Well, he didn't pick his father. Now, looking back, ending the relationship with my son at 14 was a ridiculous, stupid, selfish, ego-driven approach. I should have done something else. What would that have been? Pretend he wasn't doing drugs so we could have had a relationship? That's another option. I don't know if it's any better. So that's where the second guessing just sort of spins you around till you're paralyzed.
And there's a line in the book where one of your comedian friends talks about his own relationship with his father. And it was the father said,
My dear friend Ken Rogerson, who had been doing drugs, and his son actually started doing drugs. Now, Ken's father is dying, literally on his deathbed. And Ken goes to see his father and he's saying goodbye. And he says to his father, you know, Dad, I didn't realize a lot about life, but my son, Nicky, your grandson, is doing drugs, and I don't know what to think. And Ken told me that his father literally lifted himself up from his deathbed and said, you don't know what to think? What do you think I was going through when you were doing drugs? And Ken told me, I said to my dad, Dad, I didn't even think about you. And then Ken told me, don't think for a minute that Paul was doing drugs and said, wow, my father's really going to be upset with me. I love my father more than this. Maybe I should stop hurting him. You never came up in the conversation, in the thought process. I don't know if that's entirely true, but I think it's primarily true.
And that's one of the themes that shows up, the ego of a parent that goes through this whole elegy, that you're dealing with your own ego of this situation.
Yeah, and then the irony is that you think, well, maybe the same ego that thinks I could have changed the situation, improved it, is the same ego that in part caused it. That I was the person who had all the answers, and I didn't need to listen because I know what's right. And whatever you were going to tell me is kind of wrapped in teenage angst and, please, please, what do you have to worry about? You're a white kid in South Tulsa. Just, yeah, listen to me. This is what you need to do. And the first thing you need to do is not do drugs. And it sounds so certain, and it's so true, and he shouldn't do drugs. But you wonder, what is he hearing? What does a 15-year-old hear when the parent says, don't do drugs, you're hurting your mother? It has no little effect in some kids. So to have this catch-all approach to that, or any approach to that, there are no simple answers. I don't know if there are any answers, but there's certainly no simple answers. There's no one thing anybody, any parent can do.
You write in the book that you discovered this was happening not through catching your son in drug use. It was a card.
It was a card.
He had a New Year's resolution.
It was a New Year's resolution. He was 14. His resolution was he needed to buy drugs, a scale, and two other things.
Yeah, just normal things.
And he had to remind himself to buy drugs on this card to sell drugs to his friends. And I thought, this is hilarious and really troubling. So unapologetic about it. There was no hiding it. He literally had a card that said New Year's resolutions, and these are things he needed to buy to better sell drugs or get drugs.
This book chronicles the 4 days and the immediate aftermath of Paul's death. Can you talk about the process of writing this? It reads as though it was contemporaneous. I assume a lot of it was, but now it's been almost 12 years, so
yeah.
I assume this has gone through a lot of reflection and thought.
It was contemporaneous. I'm not sure that I wrote anything those 4 days. But a week afterwards, I was actually a stand-up comedian then. I guess I still am. I was going to Providence. I decided to do the trip, to do the gig. And I had an 18-hour layover, and then I got snowed in Charlotte. So I had about 24 hours at the airport to do nothing. And I started taking notes about the 4 days that I just experienced, because he died on a Friday. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday was the last moment that all the family was together. And then that following Friday, I went to do my gig. So he had been dead a week. And I was in the airport and just decided to start taking notes. And the first draft, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and a year later, obviously I didn't write that, but I originally titled the book Letter to My Son the Weekend He Died, because that's what it was. It was sort of a Dear Paul. And as the first line in the book is, you die today, maybe you know that. And the rest of the book was to him. But through the editing process, the publishers and editors decided they really didn't want that format, though largely that format stayed. The problem with the contemporaneous writing is you write it, and there are a lot of things you write that you wish you hadn't, characterizations of people and ex-wives and brothers and fathers, you wish you hadn't said in retrospect. But then you think, if I go back and change that, then it's not contemporaneous. It's also not honest. It's certainly not as raw. So I decided to leave that alone, the first draft alone, and just add to it more stories and memories and fix misspellings and fix transitions. But largely the impressions didn't go through a filtering process because I didn't think it was honest to do that. And if I was going to do that, then why do it at all if I wasn't going to actually describe those 4 days and that year later, that anniversary?
Again, what comes through is the classic stages of grief. And the first one is a sense of numbness, of just disbelief. And that is very apparent. Anger, especially when a situation where drugs were involved in his death. I mean, he literally died looking at his laptop.
Right.
That sort of sense comes through.
Yeah, and you don't know at the moment it's happening. And if you're self-conscious by nature, and I am, you can't help but see yourself go through it. And so when he died at his mother's house in his room. I actually saw him on this laptop. He's face down, reading his laptop. He was like typing on the floor, and I think he had a heart attack there. And I remember thinking, what is he looking at? What was the last thing he saw on this laptop? And I don't know whether that's because I'm a writer and I think about things like that, but I immediately was taken out of that moment of grief to notice the policeman's blue pant legs around him, could barely see him, and the picture of him playing basketball on the wall. And you just start taking in these moments because you realize, at least I realized, that those were the moments that were going to stay with me, those specifics, the furniture, if you would, and not so much the grief. Everybody has grief, but I wanted to drink in as much of the surroundings as I could.
Of course, in the book, there are these moments where you talk about some of the happier moments, right, younger, when he was younger, and the times when you had a good relationship. But the relationship was, it was a tough relationship, I would think. You divorced at a...
He was 8 when his mother and I got divorced, and my daughter was 3. And I just assumed that the 3-year-old, Nina, would have a much tougher time with a divorce. But as it turned out, Paul had a tougher time. In fact, I think I wrote about this in the book. One of Paul's friends told me that when my ex-wife remarried, one of the things that bothered Paul at 8 was that he'd never had the chance to be the man of the house. Mm. Now, what parent, certainly not me, would think an 8-year-old would worry about that? Or not worry about that, would want that to happen? And what parent would have the insight to say to your 8-year-old, I'm getting married, somebody else is moving in, but don't worry, you're still the man of the house, or you don't have to be, you're too young. But I never thought that was ever a consideration, something he actually wanted to do.
As you go through this roller coaster of these 4 days, you know, you see people come into his life, return to you to share their memories. Some are welcome memories, others not so welcome, especially a lot of his friends that were involved in the drug life. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, little items like a Phillies ball cap.
Yeah.
Where you guys went to a Phillies game.
We went to a Phillies game. His grandfather and the two of us went to a Phillies game. And it started raining. So I bought him a hat. And the Marlins were destroying the Phillies, like 8-1 in the third inning. And it was raining and they weren't canceling the game. And we weren't going anyway. And there was a guy in the back just cursing at the Phillies. It was the Marlins. It's not the Yankees, play ball. And Paul just had one of the best times ever sitting in the rain in this hat. Anyway, so the hat shows up at his service at Temple Israel. One of his friends brings me Paul's Phillies hat, which he had kept all these years. And I remember thinking, he kept the hat. I bought him a hat. He kept the hat. And again, there are moments like that. You make too much of them. But I said to myself, well, there's a connection. There's something he remembered about me.
Now, even though your relationship ruptured, he worked at Mario's.
Yeah.
And you would go to Mario's.
Well,
and I assume it was hoping for a way to reconnect?
It was, yeah. My thought at the time was, even though we were not talking anymore for about 1.5 years, he worked at Mario's Pizza. And used to be our favorite place. Used to go there on Friday nights, every Friday night. So my daughter and I would go to Mario's on Fridays to see Paul and to eat. And we would sit there, and we wouldn't talk. Paul and I wouldn't talk, but I would look at him. He would look at me. I did this every Friday for about 1.5 years, thinking this way he would know I'm still in his life. That's the way I thought of it. He would know his father still loves him and is here. God knows what he thought about this father who's torturing him every week by not talking to him. And all the people who would know us say, what is with him? Why would he do that to his son? And the only recognition I got from Paul that I was there is he was an oven man, which is another story. But he actually took the pizzas out of the oven. And when he would deliver them, he would tap the bottom of the pan to let me know it was hot and not to touch it, which would be a very sweet gesture, but he did that with everybody. There was no extra tap for his father. It was just tap there.
Did you ever reconnect?
We did reconnect. And not quite sure the actual moment that we reconnected, but it happened very slowly. And one story I tell in the book, which to me was just an incredibly wonderful moment. Once in a while, when he would stop doing drugs, he would start thinking about his future, and he was applying for jobs. And he had a laptop, but he didn't have Microsoft Word. He needed to send this resume off of Microsoft Word. And a few days earlier, just inexplicably, somebody else comes over and says, do you have a computer that needs Word files, Word, you know, disks? I said, no. I said, just leave it there. Just leave it on the counter. So Paul comes over and says, I really need a Word file. And I said, I don't have PC. I have a Mac. He goes, so you have no way I can get a Word? I go, wait a minute. Move the mail. And right there was a Word disk. Put it in your computer. He says, you have Word? I go, I have Word, and I have it right here. He put it in his computer. He finished his resume. He sent the resume off, and I made him a hamburger. That was not the best moment of my life with him that I can remember. So literally, this Microsoft Word was on the counter there when he needed it. When you say, I'm going to do anything I can for my son, whatever you need. There, right there, I just did it. Right now. It wasn't a promise. It wasn't, if you do this, we'll do this. It was right there.
My guest today is Barry Friedman. His book in honor of his son is titled 4 Days and a Year Later, an Elegy. This is not a cautionary tale. There's no solutions. There's no steps to heal. This is just love lost.
Love lost, apology, memoir from a flawed, omniscient observer. You know, I actually thought about, I didn't think about it. Then one of the publishers or agents asked me about my Oprah moment, what lessons I could give parents, which of course I couldn't give any. And I didn't really feel particularly, I certainly didn't feel courageous writing it, nor did I feel like I was purging myself. I didn't feel particularly better after I wrote it. I felt good that I got it out there. And as I said, that this is my son and I have something that I can remember him by, or he's out in the universe. And I make the point that if I were a painter, or, you know, I worked with trees, I would have a tree, I would, you know, paint something. So this is what I do. So no, there's no lessons here. However, what did hit me since then, and maybe you were going to ask me this anyway, is what happens next is sort of out of your hands. Because when life moves on, it moves on. What they don't tell you is it moves on whether you care or not. You wake up the next morning after somebody you love dies, and as guilty as you feel about life moving on, you get hungry, or you have to pay the light bill, or you have to go to the post office, or you have to pick somebody up at the airport, and life just moves on from that. And that moving on, sort of inverted, that's what helps you get on with life, the fact that life gets on anyway. But more specifically and more honestly, or more fundamentally, is you then can love the people in your life who are left better. You can actually look at those people and say, I can be a better person. And so, again, that assumes that you were a bad person or a bad parent. I don't know if that's exactly what's the case, but you can be a better parent, more willing to listen parent or boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife going forward. So I do see myself now with one daughter. And one of my dear friends, I asked him one time how I answer the question, you know, do you have children? He says, you have 2 children, plural. Which is a beautiful way to say this. Paul's still here, but Nina's my daughter.
One of the things I was going to ask you is, how did this change your relationship to your family, writing this book? This is a very honest portrayal. I think this is there's a lot of guilt in this book. So you probably come off worse than anyone.
Yeah, I do. And I'm glad I do, and I should have come across worse than anyone. In my mind, I mean, I was, if there was anybody responsible for Paul getting to the point in his life where he was, and I'm not sure there is, but if there was anybody, I put that on me because I was the father. And I may have written...
But again, this is the ego of the parent speaking.
Right, right. I agree. I agree. But there's also a part of me that, even knowing that, says there's one thing in your life you have to get right. That's your kids. You don't get them right, everything else is everything else.
See, this is that's guilt speaking.
Yes. Yes, it is. So how do people in my life view this? I don't know. Nobody in my life has read it yet. I'm curious how my two ex-wives will think of the book. I'm curious how my daughter, who I think comes across very well in the book, will think of it. And there's some people around me who will see themselves in the book. And again, I did not want to soften the edges of my characterization. For instance, Rabbi Sherman, who I love and has been my rabbi for 35 years, he gave the sermon, which to my mind was awful. But it wasn't his fault. Because one of the problems was when children die early is they don't have a life. So what do you talk about? How do you honor their life? I think the rabbi said, and it wasn't his fault, Paul was an oven man who liked line drawings. Really? That's it? Well, yeah, that's it. And so I'm not sure whether that understanding that, you know, this moment encompassed all that Paul never accomplished. And so I could say to you, and I believe, and maybe it's just a father talking, that Paul would have been a really good 35 or 40-year-old if he had gotten through it. Maybe every father wants to
think
that.
There's a portion of the book says, you know, if he can just make it to 30, he'll turn out okay.
Yeah. It's arbitrary, but you do think, okay, that'll be the line right there.
Well, as I was reading through the book, I think, one, it puts into perspective the loss of a close loved one. And, you know, they always say, don't make any decisions after someone dies. And I know this has happened in my own life, that this feeling of numbness and really the weeks and what's really amazing to me is you chronicle these days, because most of the time it is a blur for people when they have an experience like this. Just the ordinary death of a loved one, the expected death of a loved one, much less unexpected. And I'm wondering, I felt like it was a really good book for those that haven't experienced something like this to think about what's important in your life. You know, it's very easy not to think about, it's very easy to take for granted the most important things in your life because we are busy. We have 19,000 things going, and the idea of family, of close loved ones, of checking out your relationship with your close one, right, loved ones is something that needs to happen every day.
Which is sometimes a problem because you also want to live in the moment. And if every moment you have, you think, well, what if they die tomorrow? Let me mitigate
I'm not thinking about that.
No, but let me mitigate my behavior for the larger picture. Sometimes the smaller picture has to be dealt with. You're right that if you go back and think about relationships with your kids and how many times, of course, listening to them is sort of the go-to phrase here. But when you see your children before the drugs happen, right? Let's say there's something you can do. Well, it would certainly be before the drugs even happen. And before you talk to them about drugs, which they may not be ready to hear, you can ascertain why your children are not happy, even though it sure looks like they should be happy or they act happy. If you spend enough time realizing, wait a minute, he is miserable. This is going to lead to drugs someday or something someday if I don't figure this out. Now, the problem with doing that is, how many of us smoked pot at 16 or 17 or 18 and didn't wind up doing heroin? So you have to worry about overreacting when kids branch out while not thinking that my love for him and his love for me will keep him tethered to this reality. So, yeah, you want to be able to find those moments, see those moments, and slow them down when you need to. But I just don't know when you do that and when you realize now it's important to not be a big, not make this a big deal. And when do I decide, no, this is time to intervene? The greatest PSA ever, Carol O'Connor, when his son was doing drugs, he did the PSA, got in front of the camera. Camera was 2 inches from his face. And he said, get between your kid and the drugs any way you can if you want to save the kid's life. A wonderful sentiment and impossible. Because you can't. They're going to find drugs if they want to get drugs. Every cliche is true and doesn't work. The biggest one is they have a fighting chance to get off drugs if they want to. But if they don't and they're ambivalent, that's where it gets impossible.
And that was something that you'd gone through several times with Paul.
Right. Yeah. To the point, and I think...
And we should mention, this was an opiate death.
Yeah.
This was an opiate death before we were even hearing about opiate deaths.
Right. Right. I remember writing some essays about this here these commentaries about, I'm not sure Paul hated drugs. I'm not sure his friends who died hated drugs. They were hooked on it, and maybe somewhere they wish they could have gotten off, but I don't remember them hating doing it. I don't remember hearing anything in a person's pursuit for something that they shouldn't be doing. God, I really hate this, and I don't want to do it. And sometimes you hear adults talk about drinking. I can't wait to get my drink on. I can't wait to get drunk tonight. It's the same kind of thing. They look forward to it, even though they know on some level it will kill them. Maybe they know on some level it will kill them.
Well, what has been the reaction to this book so far? I know you've already had a couple signings around. You've had people. I know for a fact that you've said that some schools have said, talk to parents about this. I mean, is that something you're interested in doing? Or is this more just, I want to remember Paul?
Well, if I just wanted to remember Paul and didn't have some of that in mind, I would have written it and put it under the bed. It would have been a diary. I guess now that it's out there, yeah, I want people to read it, and I want people to get whatever message from it they can get. I did not think it was
even though you didn't put a message in it.
Even though I didn't put a message in it. But, yeah. Well, that's interesting, because one of the problems with writing a book like that is if you're a writer is at some point it's your memory and it's your son and it's your love, and now it's a book that has to be edited, and people have to argue over transitions, and I don't know who this person is, and this doesn't work, and get this line out of here. And so you have to think of it like a book that has to be published that people who don't know you, don't care about you, will read. So now that I'm in that camp, because the book's out, the two comments I've gotten about the book so far, one, that it's inspirational, which, as I told you, I don't see. There's no false modesty. There's nothing inspirational about it. But that's not for me to decide. The second is, forgive me, that it was somewhat courageous of me to write it, which it wasn't. It wasn't courageous, although, and if it was courageous, it was self-consciously courageous. You know, the business of watch me be courageous now by writing about my dead son and all my faults. Didn't want to do that either.
Struck me as absolution.
Yeah.
A search for absolution.
And it was an apology. A couple of days after he died, a friend of mine called me and said, what do you want to do if you write this book? I said, it'll be an apology. You're right, absolution. I don't know from who, from what. My daughter told me, Paul never blamed you. He never blamed you. Right? That should be absolution. Father doesn't hear that. Father hears a son saying, I'm not going to blame my father. I'm not going to give him I'm not going to put him in the middle of this. This is not him. This is me. But, of course, to remove your father from that equation is, of course, to blame him for not being there or for him not wanting you to be there.
The name of the book is 4 Days and a Year Later, an Elegy. It's a beautiful book. It's a hard book to read at times, but it's an important book, I think. Barry Friedman, thanks very much for joining
us. Rich, thank you.
Writer, comedian, and Studio Tulsa commentator Barry Friedman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled 4 Days and a Year Later, an Elegy. He'll be signing the book a week from tonight, Wednesday, January 15th at 5:30 at the Tulsa Press Club. That event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.